Why is it important to be able to tell whether a revival is genuine or false? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Alden Thompson, your host and study guide author, as we continue our series on revival and reformation. Our theme for today is discernment, the safeguard of revival. My conversation partners are again Dave Thomas and Daryl Bigger from the Walla Walla University School of Theology. All right, men, why do we need to determine whether a particular revival is genuine or not? Why should that be a crucial issue?
Well, I think that's the why question here is not a difficult one. To me, the how would be far more difficult. How do you tell if it's a genuine one or not? But why, I think, is simply that if you value revival as something genuine, there is likely that it could be counterfeited. And therefore, you would want to discern whether or not this is actually a genuine one in order to be caught up in the right things and not in foolishness.
In other words, you see it in terms of my participation in. Here is a revival. Should I become involved in it?
Well, sure.
Or could one say that if that someone thinks it's a revival and blessings on them, let them do it. I don't have to participate in it. Because if I go through this city, for example, your more conservative churches would sponsor revivals. Do I need to go in there and find out if they are genuine? At what point does that become a serious issue as far as me personally is concerned and my circle of friends, my circle of believers?
Well, in my mind, you raise an interesting question that's a little bit tangential here, but I'm going to give it a shot anyway, Alden, is that the whole issue of revivals is an interesting one, because why is it that we keep needing revivals? You know, revivals kind of make a very wavy experience, up and down, up and down. I wonder if we could not envision the Christian walk more as a constant climb instead of a revival and then a sliding away and then another revival and a sliding away. To me, a revival is like a forest fire. It burns hot for a while and then goes out. Nobody likes forest fires, but everybody's attracted by a good campfire. And I sometimes wonder if we shouldn't understand our lives more as creating a warm fire to which other people are invited to sit instead of having these big highs and lows. I'm not against revivals. What I'm saying is that to characterize the whole of Christian life that way, I think, can be a bit of a struggle, can produce a struggle.
Let me try another comparison there. Both you men are actively involved in significant numbers of marriage counseling experiences. Can the religious life be drawn, can a parallel be made between the religious life and the life of a married couple? And if so, what would revival and reformation look like in a married situation?
What you're suggesting there is that times in which we devote ourselves specifically to one another create kind of bursts of emotional connection, intimacy, and bonding that is useful in the long term in that relationship. That would be the value of revivals, I would see, although I think you make a very good point, Dave, that to be sort of manic depressive about our religious experience is in itself unhealthy. On the other hand, there certainly come times when, as we've talked about before during this series, when the Spirit moves communities of people in unusual ways. And for me, the reason to be certain this revival is on target or not is to ameliorate, to soften the slump afterward so that it works toward building rather than deflating the whole experience. I think about sports events, for example. At a time of a ball game where one team has a surge of energy and immerses itself in pushing ahead toward excelling, that can give a morale boost that elongates itself for the rest of the game. So I think those spurts of energy are more how I would see the advantage of a revival.
Yeah, and I would agree that revivals are necessary simply because of the perversity of the human heart. You know, the human heart drifts away and a revival does pull people back. I wish that Christian living or faithful living was more consistent is the point I was making.
So. Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Now, part of the issue in looking at discernment, again, if I look at Adventist history, we've always been pretty clear about what's truth and what's not truth. And we've been fairly quick to say, this is Babylon, this is not Babylon, and even Babylon has fallen. Come out of her, my people. That was much easier when you weren't closely tied with a particular community. In fact, early Adventists had a tough time immediately following the disappointment because they changed traditional Protestant language. Instead of saying it's the Roman Catholics who are Babylon, they said it's not only the Roman Catholics, it's those other Protestants. And William Miller in particular was sorry that he had jumped onto that bandwagon where he called other people Babylon. Now, the reason I mention that is if you are constantly attacking other people for what is wrong, that eats out your own heart.
Mm-hmm.
And I think of in the Adventist community, again, too many people were coming close together. Ellen White said, you shouldn't all move to Battle Creek. Get away. You know, too many intense people make life difficult. But in her later years, she moved away from that confrontational point. Instead of attacking people where they're wrong, you work with people on where you can agree.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we take that as a principle, how would you establish that from Scripture?
I think you can illustrate that with other religious communities as well, Alden, the way in which we distinguish ourselves from mm-hmm. other groups. And some studies would indicate that we tend to be more sensitive to define our distinctions with those who are most like us, because the confusion is most probable there. And so that leads us in a kind of a natural human way to fight most intensely with people who are most like us.
Can you give me some examples of that from a church point of view?
Yeah, I think the internal struggles we have, for example, of what happens when a person dies. Look at the way in which that took place in Christianity. Look at the struggles about how we view salvation, and the split that created between Roman Catholics and Protestants in Western Christianity. Look at the way in which music is used or not used in Eastern Christianity and Western Christianity. Those kinds of things, the sub-distinctions, disidentify us from those mm-hmm. who are like us.
Well, even today, the issues of contemporary music are really problematic. I remember there's one church in the Northwest where they had a division over music, the traditionalists versus the contemporary music, and they ended up in the church having contemporary music early, there were some in the, should we say, older group who were so upset about that, that when they would come into the church after that contemporary music service, they would actually have to pray that the Lord would cleanse that sanctuary so they could have worship again.
Wow.
I mean, you're a long ways from working together when it comes that far.
Well, and we see the same thing in the political world today that is not directly connected with religion.
Mm-hmm.
We are just cantankerous beings,
mm-hmm.
The kind of smash-mouth politics that won't work on compromises but confronts people continuously, creates the kind of dissension that's here.
Well, let me ask a question, and now that you mentioned politics, it seems to me that you can break human events, affairs, down into really kind of two impulses, the one who is self-contained, active, and the one who is more dependent. I used to talk about this when our girls were little. I had one girl, my speech, she would say to me, carry me, Daddy. The other one would say, let me do it. See, that represents the two impulses behind the Calvinist.
Uh-huh.
And the free will.
Uh-huh.
The Calvinists would say, carry me, Daddy. You know, God does everything for them. whereas the free will people would say, let me do it. And historically, there's a real danger when you take that free will position. Adventists face that danger because we are in the free will community, that you begin to rationalize, you reason, and those things which used to be perfectly clear suddenly become hazy and they disappear. You see the extreme example of this in the Methodist community. Methodist recently, I understand from a Methodist, have finally decided that their seminary students should take at least one course on the Bible. Many years ago, I had a Methodist pastor come talk to our church, to my students, and he simply said, God is not a person, heaven is not a place. And the students didn't even know where to start to ask a question. So finally someone said, well, where is God? And he said, well, we swim in God. Well, that is so far removed. It's the product of a questioning experience on one side, whereas on the other side, if you have affirming one where you don't ask any questions at all, then you go end up with a different kind of solution.
But hold on, you know, we're talking about discerning the veracity or the truthfulness of the Bible by doctrinal points. But I think there's some experiential ones too. Mm-hmm. What is it producing? What is it producing in the lives of its adherents? Mm-hmm. Is it producing hope? Is it producing joy? Is it taming the soul of the person who has been revived? And is it doing good in the land?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I look at the Great Awakening that civilized a whole frontier, in effect, mm-hmm. to the mm-hmm. point where the church was looked more to for reasons of discipline than even to the government, because the government didn't exist. And, you know, the reforming of personal lives, the reviving of communal life, I think should be some of the products from a revival that I want to see.
But looking at the fruits, Dave, is very much a Methodist free will type of thing.
No.
And I'm fully agree with that. But you see, a Calvinist would would not admit that as a valid test at all. You know, for instance, at the 1888 General Conference in Adventism, when Ellen White said, for the first time, I recognized that we did not have the proper position at all on this issue because the truth required no such spirit to defend it. See, she was applying the test of experience, the one that you just mentioned there, and I think he's entirely right. If my view of truth doesn't make me a better, kinder, more gracious person, then I need to take that back to the drawing boards.
Or at least the way you incorporate it into your life.
Anyway. That's right. Yeah, that's true. But it looks like the clock is against us again, and we're going to have to pick up these pieces again next week. And our lesson for next week is Reformation, the outgrowth of revival. I want to thank Dave and Daryl for their help. Also want to thank Chet Ofterhauer, program engineer, and my thanks to each of you for listening in. With a good word, I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.